taking a look at the world of insects on the Ideas Network. Today, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. Phil Pelletieri back with us. He is, of course, the former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, retired in 2014, and comes by every couple of months to talk with us about what's going on in the world of insects. And I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got something bugging you, so to speak. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a photo of an insect you want to identify, or maybe just a cool photo of an insect, you can send it to ideas@wpr.org, and you can also send a question that way as well. So looking forward to hearing from you, and in the meantime, Phil Pelletieri, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, good to see you again. So what types of bugs are we most likely to be seeing coming into the home this time of the year?
Well, this is the perfect date to get prepared for the onslaught that you typically see in the fall of the things that like to come in the winter rent-free. So it's box elder bugs and cluster flies and Asian lady beetles, and now the new kid on the block is the stink bug, the marmorated stink bug. And so different things trigger things, but we're at a point, you've got about 2 weeks, I think, to really get your guard up, get things tightened up and the like. Asian lady beetle, we know we need a good hard freeze before they start coming in. Cluster flies are probably already wandering in. My first take on box elder bugs, they typically don't do well in wet years, and I haven't seen a lot yet, and so I'm not thinking
either.
That's going to be a whole big problem. But I've seen more stink bugs. That continues to increase in numbers in the state, so I have a feeling that that's going to be the most problematic this year.
And certainly tightening up the home. And when you're talking tightening, I know there's certain areas where they seem to...
Yeah, the rule for most of these things is that they climb upwards.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about soffits, you're talking about window frames, you're talking about roof fence. Because even if they're screened with a screen mesh to keep the birds out, sometimes that mesh is still big enough to allow insects in. So again, there are some physical things. And what we always try to preach about this is if you solve the riddle of how they're getting in, you're done. If you have to rely on insecticide sprayed on the outside of the house, that's a temporary fix. It might save you from this year from the big numbers, but, it has to be done every year. And the other thing for all of these things that is confusing to people, but no matter what you see all winter and next spring, everything came in this fall.
Yeah,
you know, it's
right
not
about
they
now.
They do not breed in your house, but boy, they can really pack in if the conditions are right.
What's the worst you've ever seen in a house?
Oh, I've seen cluster flies 5-6 inches deep in an attic.
Oh.
I've seen Asian lady beetles, again, maybe not quite that deep, but to the point that there's a couple inches deep in places. And I had one case that really was interesting. The person sent me and claimed that the Asian lady beetles rotted his window frame. And what had happened is they got underneath the plastic siding and they were packed so tight. And I'm sure they added some moisture so you could see a major stain in moisture damage. And so he was right. I was surprised till I saw the picture, but then you could see the conditions were probably such. And again, in that case, they never got access to the house, but it's just they could get and squeeze so tight under there. And then again, the moisture in the bodies. And, you know, so many of these things don't survive the winter. But the problem with that is dead bugs in your wall or attic can give you carpet beetles and larder beetles, you know.
Yeah.
So it's all kinds of issues.
Well, let's take some calls. Again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Some open lines get you on pretty quickly. Betty in Mayville, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have, I would like a remedy, and I don't know the name of these little critters, but they're like worms, and when you touch them, they curl up in a little ball. I have them in my lower level, which is finished, but I'm also noticing upstairs in my living quarters.
Mm-hmm.
What are they, and how the heck can I get rid of them?
Okay, so this is another invader. They're millipedes, and if you look real closely at them, they got lots of little legs. In fact, two pair for every one of their little body ring segments. And what goes on with millipedes is you can get invasions almost any time of the year, although mid to late summer and fall are more common. And at night, they're wandering around, and the frustration is that they could be coming from 50 yards, 100 yards away. And so at night, they're crawling. When the sun comes up, they look for places that are cool, damp, and dark. And so they often will accumulate along the north side of the house on the foundation. But also, sometimes they squeeze in. It's a dead end for them. They can't breed inside. It's too dry. They often die, and then they get crunchy if you've ever stepped on them. So the first thought is really, again, looking in this case, not high. This is one insect that you would look where your foundation meets the siding and get that caulked or stuffed with steel wool or some way that they can't physically push themselves in. I'm not as big a proponent on spraying for these because oftentimes where they're coming from, I mean, you can spray the outside foundation, you kill a few critters, but some always get through and then end up dying in the house, so you haven't gained a whole lot there. And you're really not getting at the source of the problem. You know, another common one, we'll see them accumulate on garage slabs because it's cool and damp.
Sure, yeah.
And again, people spray that thinking that they're coming from there, and that said, all you should do is sweep them up, get from there. The bigger change, and this is where it gets difficult, is if you knew where they're coming from, they're feeding on organic matter in the soil. And if there's a land use change, sometimes you see, but that's often out of people's control. So it could be, you know, a field, it could be a prairie is a great place for millipedes to be in high numbers, and they migrate out of that site. And there really is not a whole lot of real practical things you can do to stop that other than physically trying to keep them from squeezing into the house.
So there you go. Betty, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. Let's take another call. Barb in Bell Center, on to you now. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I'm so thrilled to be on. I have a question, a maggot question. And there was a huge raccoon dead along the side of the road, and I just kept watching because I just walk by it every day. And after about 3 days, there were no flies or anything on it. After about 3 days, the whole carcass was full of these little maggots. You could not see the raccoon body at all. It was so covered. And about 3 days later, all the maggots were gone. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering,
what the heck happened
to them? Where did they come from and where did okay. they go?
So honestly, this is the baseline of science that we use for forensics, for figuring out, you know, death intervals and whatnot. We use maggots. And there are blowflies and there are flesh flies that will literally either lay eggs or in some cases lay live maggots onto the carcass. And they do this very quickly. You can find that within an hour or two of death, they're already there. And then the maggots develop very quickly. And although temperature influences how fast this happens, as everything with insects, we find with maggots, when you get enough of them, they generate their own heat. So they literally develop faster than the air temperature would tell you. But what's very typical is when they complete their feeding cycle, and it can range from 3 to as much as 10 to 14 days if it's cooler, they will migrate off the carcass and then pupate, which is their transformation stage, and then the fly will emerge 3 or 4 days later, or in some cases, not until next spring. It just depends on the time of the year. So it's a real interesting phenomena. And as the name blowfly, you often think when animals die, they often bloat. And well, that's when many of the flies are coming to it. And flesh fly, the same thing. They're attracted to the foul odors, although they can pick up, you know, scents that we don't pick up very easily. But usually if an animal's at the point that, you know, it smells of decay, I guarantee you that it's probably got maggots, whether internally or not. And the good news about that is they break that down very quickly, you know, so that the carcass doesn't sit there as long. And then there's other insects that move on later. And then understanding that whole progression of what comes when is, again, what we use sometimes to figure out death investigations, how long a body was exposed, those kinds of things.
Very interesting. Barb, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Dean in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Dean.
Hi. I live on the water, and all of us that live on the water and have our boats tied up to our dock deal with spiders all the time. Just wondering what we could use or something as a deterrent so we don't have to, you know, they poop all over your upholstery and they just make a mess. I was wondering if you know something. I use citronella right now. That helps a little bit, but I was wondering if you have something else I could use to deter them.
Yeah, citronella is basically made for repelling mosquitoes, and spiders I don't think will have. You know, maybe on a real close contact, they might have a little bit of an aversion. So the first thing is that you expect a lot of spiders by water because there's a lot of insects coming off the water. And if you've got security lighting on your pier or around the house, you're just drawing them, and the spiders are taking advantage of that. You know, the thing about it is sometimes even going through with a vacuum cleaner every 3 to 4 weeks, you know, and kind of sucking things up honestly helps because spiders don't breed quickly. Like, you know, some insects, like we talk about the flies, can explode in a week or two. Spiders don't work that way. They're much slower. On the other hand, there's plenty of spiders around. And so The problem with, there are some sprays that could be used. There's even commercial people that will come out and spray for spiders. But it gets a little tricky in the water because some of these chemicals are not good to get in contact with the water. They're not good for fish. And so, you know, it does take some expertise to use them properly. So as I said, you can look at contracting service. I think the argument there I would make is one, at most two applications in a summer should be sufficient. I don't see a reason for somebody to come every 2 weeks or a month to spray for spiders. And typically you spray in those areas where the spiders are expected. It's kind of underneath overhangs and that kind of things where spiders are often setting up their nest. But so I go back to, I become more of a proponent for physically getting with a shop vac and whatnot, an extension, and probably getting almost as much bang for the buck as using chemicals in this case.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks very much for calling, Dean. Let's turn to Fred in Ashland next. Hi, Fred.
Hello. I just killed a fly in my truck, and four little crawlers came off of it. Is there other insects that hitchhike on houseflies?
Yeah, well, there's two thoughts to that one. It, again, could be one of these flesh flies that carry live young with it. But I think if these things were big enough for you to see, most likely these are parasites inside the fly. You know, insects have all kinds of things. If you remember the movie Alien, that's the way a whole lot of insects work as far as laying their eggs in other kinds of animals and then these things developing internally. And so my first guess in a fly, in an adult fly, is they're probably some kind of wasp larvae. And, you know, some of these things attack eggs, some of them attack the larvae, some attack the pupae, but they often wait till the adults come out and emerge. So it's one of those two things. It's either a flesh fly, and those are just its larvae. And that's, as he said, very atypical because most insects lay eggs. They don't give birth to live young like flesh flies. Or secondly, it is parasitic. If you see caterpillars and whatnot, this is very common to have maggot-like creatures crawl out of caterpillars, and what those are either fly or wasp larvae.
Yuck. There you go, Fred. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. Judy in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I was digging in my yard to plant a bulb yesterday, and when I dug a hole, I got down about 2 inches or so. And when I shoveled the dirt out, the hole was full of the tiny, tiny little ants. And every single ant was carrying this tiny little speck of white. And I was wondering what that speck of white is.
That's technically a baby ant. And what they are is the larvae of ants. You know, people, the ants that you see are all adults. The immature stage of an ant is a maggot-like creature, and it is almost totally helpless. But that's what ants do, is they take care of their young. And if the nest was disturbed, they would go a long way of trying to get those young out of there and get them to a safer place. Now, sometimes what you'll see, it's somewhat bigger, and it's kind of more of a brownish, almost the color of a cardboard. And those are the pupal cases. And if you were to look real closely, they're silk. And the larvae is developing inside, and then the adult ant will come out from there. So in ant colonies, you see it. The eggs are really quite small. In most ants in our state, I would not expect to have eggs at this time of the year because very soon they're going to run out of food and it's going to be too cold to move. And so this is not the time to raise young. And so most ants, you know, are most active in the spring. There's still enough time for these larvae to develop into adult ants. And then what's typical of most of our native ants in Wisconsin is they will spend the winter as a colony dormant and then wake up again in the spring and then continue their activity.
There you go, Judy. So you were watching a lot of little baby ants there. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest as we talk bugs with him. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Dinner, our engineer today. Stephanie Hoff, our producer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. If you have a question for our guest today, Phil Pelletieri, an entomologist extraordinaire, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. And we've gotten some really cool photos, Phil, for you to identify. Brian emailed a photo of a moth, and I don't even know how to describe it.
Okay, the moth picture, I see Peggy's and I see Barb's.
Oh, you don't see Brian.
Oh, there's Brian. Okay. So that's a wild silkworm, although that's the most common one we see is Cecropia, which is more of a gray base. This is Promethea, which is related to this. Now, wild silkworms are interesting because they are the largest moths that we have in the state. The adults are very short-lived, don't even have functional mouth parts. Now, because I'm familiar with this one, that looks like a female, both because of the color pattern. The males are a little bit darker.
Interesting.
We're talking, if its wings were expanded, probably about 5 inches, 4.5 to 5
wow.
inches. And they're really a little bit more common than people think, but they're such great bat food. They don't last very long.
No.
And so oftentimes you just don't get the pleasure of getting to see them. Yeah, that's what we would always think trophies in this state if you're a butterfly or moth collector. This particular one, the caterpillars feed quite extensively on wild cherry. And so you can see things in the Prunus group if you can find it. And, you know, most young entomologists usually like to collect these and collect the cocoons so we can, you know, share them with their moms and dads and that kind of stuff. And so that really is a nice picture. And I will make the comment, I probably have made it before on the show, but the whole idea of digital cameras to me back when I started, of course, was so foreign, but it was one of the greatest inventions because there was a whole lot of things that people would send me to look at that you never would have been able to catch or like. So I think, you know, on PG, I think would agree with me, is we get a much better sense of what's going on out there because people are much more likely to send some of these neat images.
Yeah. Here's another one from Peggy, kind of a green worm-like thing.
Okay, so same family.
Yeah.
This critter is about 4 inches long and as big around as your thumb. This happens to be the caterpillar of the Polyphemus moth, which is more of a light tan with nice blue eye spots and also some maroon in its wings.
Now it's a lime green.
Well, that's the caterpillar.
Yeah.
And so it will spin a cocoon. And the game for all of our species here is to spend the winter as the cocoon stage. And then it needs a cold shock. And then after the cold shock, it'll emerge next May or June. Now, the problem, if you have a caterpillar and it spins cocoon and you bring it in your house, the chance of it emerging is really very reduced because without that cold shock, the chance of it coming out is probably 10% instead of, you know, close to 100%. So this one often will make its cocoon in a leaf, but often in the ground level. Cecropia Promethea are more likely to spin on leaves that are up in the trees. So sometimes when the leaves fall, you can collect them at that time.
And then we had Barb from Little Suamico sent this image, wants to know what it is, found in northeastern Wisconsin. Another pretty one.
So this is another moth, but a different family. This is from the hawk moth group, or we call them sphinx moths is another name. And this one is a white line sphinx. White lines are quite interesting because the caterpillar comes in about 5 or 6 color phases.
We're seeing the caterpillar.
Seeing the caterpillar. And if you can look very closely on the bottom, you see this red thorn-like structure, and that's why they get the term hornworm, because many of the larvae of this family have these kinds of structures. The way they get through the winter is to crawl in the ground and transform there. The other one, there's another highly species this possibly could be. It's a species that was brought in for spurge control. Without getting a real close look at it, I'm not 100% sure, but it's definitely in that genus, whether it's white line or this other species. It's a trophy. It's 3 inches long and a great photographic subject. I mean, you'd think on an insect side that this is not smart being that brightly colored and ornate. Usually insects like to be a little bit more camouflaged to protect them. So
let's take another call. And Dick in Viroqua, we'll go to you now. Hi, Dick.
Hi. We have a cabin up on Lake Arbutus, and we have landscaping up against the cabin. And last month we found all kinds of black spots on the wall and on the windows. And so I began scrubbing them off, and you know, I got to use a scraper and then a brush and soap and water, and you know, it cleared up like 20 feet up on the house.
Yeah.
And my wife found out that it's arterial fungus.
Sure. No, it's artillery fungus.
Artillery fungus.
And the reason it gets that name, it shoots the spores. So this is all Brian Huddleston's fault. At least we'll blame him. But The thing about that fungus is it grows on decaying wood material, so it's often influenced by mulch and the like that you have along the side of the house. It's more problematic in damp areas, so the north side. And so the idea is if you get rid of the stuff that grows the fungus, they stop shooting spores. And the spores are really tough. I remember dealing in my career with a couple insurance companies because people would file claims, and then it gets real messy as far as what's going on. Because in some cases, when people are trying to remove this, it removes the paint, you know, yeah. And then you get spotting and the like. So it really is problematic. But as I said, if you alter the environment, I don't know of any chemical remedy for this, but if you alter the environment, get things as dry as you can and try to get rid of any bark mulch in particular, because that's often the substrate that grows the fungus.
Yeah, I had some success with that on the lake home that we had. Just getting rid of that helped a lot. But I tell you what, Dick's right. It is miserable to try and clean.
And people often equate it with spider spots or some insect poop type things, which you do run into some cases. But this stuff, it hardens almost like cement, and it seems to change color. As the older it is, the darker it gets. Yes. And to me, the harder it is to remove.
Yeah. Dick, there you go. Thank you so much. Mary in Oshkosh, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I'm hoping that you can resolve a problem that is being blamed on spiders. I do some volunteering at the Horicon National Refuge.
Yep.
And we had a couple of guys come in last week. They frequent the refuge and do photography. And one of the fellas went into a photo blind that is out on the refuge and came away with a lower torso full of bites, and bad enough that he went to the doctor, and the doctor said it was spider bites. And they came in to let us know about this, so that we could do something about it. And I was skeptical because I've heard you say so many times that spiders don't bite or are not capable of biting. And so what I'm wondering is, what is this that might be sitting in this blind that they've used before, mm-hmm. but this time have come away with their torsos full of some kind of a bite.
So did they mention at all where the bite's kind of confined, where clothing is somewhat restricted, like the belt line and the sock line, or was it more generally distributed along the legs?
They seem to indicate generally along the legs, although I think it stopped at the belt.
Okay. So my first guess is bird mites. My second guess is rodent mites, and they're really closely related. But birds have little tiny mites. They almost look like tiny ticks. And if your humans are exposed to them, you get bit. They don't burrow or anything, but you can get quite a reaction. In fact, it often gets almost a little blistery, is quite common. And I'm just wondering if this blind, if there were birds there, or as I said, mice, which you almost might expect in a blind like that. I haven't seen that many rodent mites in my career, but I am aware of them. And the same thing is that they are parasites of mice. And if there are mouse nests there and then you're sitting around, it's often when the mice leave or the birds leave that the mites get hungry and then they pick on the people. And so that would be my guess, more likely in spiders. I mean, occasionally somebody can get a spider bite, but it is definitely not multiple bites. I never go towards spiders. That's just not the way they work. And this does fit in the environment, as I said, would support either the bird side or the rodent side, that they are parasitic mites. So one of the things people can try to do is use the same kind of tick sprays that you would use on your clothing and in your socks, because mice being related will be affected by that. And this way you can keep them out. They usually run their course pretty quick, because if the host is gone, they dry up and die, mm-hmm. So they're not really that serious. And I always warn people when you do hear about bird mites is that some of the information on the internet is really very misleading. In fact, the birdmite.com site used to drive me crazy, because the people would claim that they get in your house, you could never get rid of them, and it's kind of like a science fiction movie, and that's just not the way the biology is of these critters. But if you get exposed to them, it is not a pleasant experience, as I said, because you often get blistery-type bites that are going to itch and bother you for a couple of weeks.
So there you go, Mary. And so if they just leave those tents without anybody in them for a while? Would they?
Well, it depends if the rodents are still in there. You try to get rid of the rodents, in other words. Yeah, as I said, I think knowing that's a problem, you warn people that are going to use that again. And indeed, if they do, I think I would use some kind of tick repellent on my clothing to help protect me. And it's another good idea to, when you're done, get into the shower and kind of wash down. So
there you go. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate the call. Another Mary, this one from Middleton with us now. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Hi, guys.
Hi.
I have a question about some little brown beetles. We built this house about 14 years ago, and the problem just started probably about 2 years ago. We have a set of stairs from our garage going into the basement. And at the foot of the stairs, we have noticed and have been killing multiple brown, little brown beetles, probably a half an inch to three quarters of an inch long. And my husband sprays the three sides, the foot of the stairs and the two walls. They do not come into the house, and they're always dead. And I'm saying probably a dozen to two dozen dead. We find maybe every 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
What could they be?
So the picture, I think that's the picture that was sent. Did you send a picture or not?
No, I didn't.
Okay,
no.
Okay. So there was another little brown critter. So in my first inclination, it gets tough with little beetles because there's so many things that look alike. But given the reoccurrence in the history, I'm tending to go towards a fungus beetle or plaster beetle type of critter. And I'm wondering if there's somewhere in that interface of where the stairs and the house meet or whatnot that it's prone to get moisture. Because as the name implies, these things feed on mold and fungus. And then they kind of emerge. And what's typical of most of them is they're capable of flying under certain circumstances. Whereas there are similar little reddish bugs that you get in cereal and birdseed and that kind of stuff. And those typically do not fly. So that would be my first guess. But in a case like this, as I said, because I can come up with a half a dozen explanations, that might be worth getting a specimen and send it to PJ at the lab.
Yeah.
Because then he'll nail it right down exactly what it is. And, you know, for one of them, you kind of dry it out. If it turns out to be this kind of thing that we associate with pet food and birdseed, then you got to hunt that down. But one would think that whatever that food source would get exhausted and then they would disappear. And because this is reoccurring, again, it sounds to me like an environment that gets refreshed. And that's why I go back to the possibility that they're one of these. It's more typical to see these fungus beetles and mold-feeding beetles in the late summer and fall.
Yeah.
You know, and once you get in the heating season and whatnot and things dry out, they're gone.
They go away.
Yeah.
So the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, if you just put that into your search engine.
Right. The address is 1630 Linden Drive here in Madison. The university zip is 53706. And again, it depends how good your pictures are. For this kind of thing, PJ is going to need really a pretty good image because sometimes we have to count the antennal segments and other kind of subtle things, figuring out exactly who it is. But as I said, it just kind of fits. And this is the time of the year. It's interesting. We get this complaint in brand new houses. And there what we think is that the green lumber that comes in is high enough moisture that we're getting a little bit of mold and mildew in the walls. And literally then we're attracting the beetles from outside in the fall. But once you go through a heating season, everything dries out. You never see them again. And again, what's confusing is it's people are probably more likely seeing little brown bugs coming out of the pantry rather than realizing that some of these are associated, as I said, with mold and that kind of thing.
So there you go, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Dave in Waukesha next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. I have a question related to wasps. A year ago, I had wasps going in and out underneath the siding on the house, and I had somebody come out, and we got rid of them. And he told me that the following year they would probably not be back because they don't use the same nest year after year. And I guess that's what my first question is whether that's true.
Yes, he's
and
true.
Then I went down into the crawl space, and there was a paper wasp nest that was probably 2 feet in diameter between the floor joists. So I'm kind of worried about if there's anything in there that would still be coming out, or will they pretty much be gone?
Yeah.
And I'll just listen to the show and listen to the answer after that.
So what happens with all our paper wasp nests, the ground nesting ones, which is the kind of form that you've got that went in the house or the ones that are above, is they do not spend the winter. And so it's usually the 1st of November is the kind of the date I use that they have starved out and died out. And the only thing that survives are some of the queens, which have to start everything from scratch the next year. And they typically do, well, they do not use their, reuse the nest. And it's quite typical to see activity in the late summer because that's when their numbers are high, whereas in the spring it starts with a single queen. And I'll make a general comment in that this has been extremely quiet year for yellow jackets. Yes, it has. There are times that, you know, by the middle of August, you can't eat or drink outside without being bothered by these things. I have not seen any of that going on. So that's kind of the good news. And usually what we try to evaluate is what's the potential risk of problems if we just let them run their course, or is the nest located in a place where a pet or people walk by and we have to be concerned about that? And the one thing you do not want to do is plug the entrance without dealing with it first, because all that does is drive them elsewhere, and they often will come out in the house and create all kinds of problems if we do that. General rule is if it's an above-ground nest, the area wasp sprays you buy at the hardware store are great. You just soak the nest. I like to do it right away in the morning or just about at dusk because I know everybody's home at the time. If it's a ground nest or something that's going up in the siding, I don't like the sprays as much as I like dusts. They perform better, but they're harder to apply. But you know, you put the dust in the hole, and when they come and go, it does them in. Or in the case of the siding, sometimes you have to use something like a turkey baster to blow the dust into that entrance. After a couple, 3 days, when there's no more activity, then you can plug the hole and you're done with it. But as I said, I emphasize, do not plug the hole until the nest is dealt with, because right now a colony, if it's strong enough, could have 2,000 individuals. I've seen them eat their way through wallboard and other things trying to escape. And then, as I said, it's a much more complicated problem trying to deal with.
Or if it's not too much of an issue right now, just leave it alone and it'll be dead in November.
You know, the above ground nests are above 10 feet. Why bother? You know, you run more of a risk. The ones that we have the bigger problem with are the ground nesting ones when people are mowing lawns and the like, and they are not aware that they're. That's when you talk about people getting multiple stings. But I think, again, what is interest, we're already late enough in September. One would think if one of those nests were there, you would notice the activity. And if you don't know exactly where it is, they always seem to be around the tree trunk. It's worth just sitting off to the side and observe. Because, again, if you're going to have to go after it, you have to know exactly where the nest is. And often you can see them coming and going and crawling into crevices and the like, and then you know that's the place you got to deal with.
There you go, Dave. Thank you so much for calling. Joe in Monroe has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hey, guys. Hey, my wife and I found a little bug in our bed the other day. I tried sending in a picture. The bug to me looked about the same size as an adult lice or as an adult mosquito without the legs on it. The back part of it didn't have perpendicular stripes to the body. It almost looked like it was kind of like a gray or silver, and it almost looked like the stripes on the back ran parallel to the body. But my wife had a couple bites on her, and we don't know if it was from this bug. We're hoping it's not bed bugs. And then I also sent in a picture of a spider that we had found on our wall. So I'm just kind of wondering, can you tell from that picture if it is indeed a bed bug? And if that could make the bite that I sent in, or if you'd have any ideas there, really appreciate it.
The critter you sent in is not a bed bug, for sure. I mean, it's kind of the general color, but the shape isn't right and the like. Bites are so hard to call in that oftentimes the more you know of what somebody's been doing the last couple of days, they've been outside, you know, what you've been exposed to, if you've been over by a friend's house that have pets that might have fleas. I mean, all these. And we get some wild ones. I mean, even with the bed bugs, until the human bed bug problems of the last 10 to 15 years, I used to get a bed bug associated with bats that would come into people's houses. Occasionally would bite somebody, but usually more it was just the presence. And all it told me is they got bats in the attic, and then that had to be dealt with. So, I wouldn't worry too much. You know, the bed bugs side, you know, if you've been traveling and the like, you always get a little nervous because we do see probably more problems in hotels and, you know, youth hostels and those kind of things just because as the way people are kind of coming and going and the like. But if you've not been traveling, I just don't see how you're going to get human bed bugs other than, you know, we warn our students here when people are moving in the middle of August and often they're finding chairs and, you know, table lamps
sofas
and other things, sofas sitting out the curb. That's probably one of the prime ways that we get bed bugs introduced into apartments here is on used furniture. in mattresses and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I don't think I'd worry about this critter. If you, the bat bug is a little bit hairier than human bed bug, but that's relative. If you're not used to seeing them, you might not be able to pull that through. But same thing. I mean, if this persists, you see any more. But so many miscellaneous things can be from outside that just kind of come in on your clothing and then they show up in the bed and not worry. It's when you start to see multiples of things that there's got to be something more going on.
There you go, Joe. Speaking of furry, Mary Beth from New Berlin sent us a bright yellow caterpillar photo, a furry devil.
Right.
Wonders if they cause illness, if they crawl on your skin as well.
Sure. So what's a giveaway for this one? If I look closely, there are some black, what we call pencil hairs, sticking out. They almost look like spines, but what they are is long black hairs. That makes this critter a dagger moth, which is a type of cutworm. Now, not all, but some hairy caterpillars, their hairs can cause a skin rash. And it's more or less if you rub against them or pet them, it's not as if these hairs, if they're just crawling on you, you're not going to have a problem. But if you rub, now, I'm not aware of the dagger moth having that kind of defense, but there are things like the Io moth and other ones that we do, and even gypsy moth. Honestly, their caterpillars have been known to cause some skin rashes on people. Nothing worse than that, but again, it's an unpleasant experience. So, this dagger moth, nothing to worry about. Again, in other parts of the world, there are some very crazy, nasty kind of critters, but we don't worry about those in North America.
And one more, we got a new friend here, shield-shaped.
Yeah, so this is a giant water bug, or the other name for it is an electric light bug. And they typically live in ponds and lakes. And in the fall of the year, they migrate to bigger water surfaces, because if you're in a little pond that's freezing, that's not a good place to stay. And they're attracted to night lights. Now, these are big-time predators. They feed on fish and other things. And they will not go out of their way to bite you, but you do not pick them up and allow them to bite you because it would catch your attention
like
very quickly. So, you know, you can grab them from behind. I said they're not real active, but they're an interesting insect, one of the larger insects in the state. And as I said, normally you'd have to go in a pond with a fish net to catch them because you don't see them. But at night, sometimes they're attracted to lights, and then you find them underneath the light the next morning.
Kathy and Madison will go to you next. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I also have a problem with yellow jackets. They have come in to a gap between a window and the metal piece above it. We've had an exterminator come. He came on the 4th, and he put some special spray in there. And then we started seeing some of these wasps, or yellow jackets come out into a bedroom, and we're not exactly sure where. We're thinking maybe the gap between the heat vent and the framing. And my husband looked in the attic, couldn't see any nests. They still kept coming. Some flew, some were dead, some were lethargic when we found them. We called the exterminator again, and after 3 days, my husband did seal up the gap because we didn't see any more going in and out. And anyway, so they're still there, and the exterminator came back yesterday. We opened up the hole, and he sprayed in more of this powerful stuff, and then he also put some spray around some baseboards in the bathroom and the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
That going to be sufficient to get rid of these? We think they must be between the wall on the inside and the wall on the outside. We don't know. My husband went in the bedroom, killed swept up 100 of them last evening. They're just everywhere. We keep every door shut.
Right. So, you know, the good news part is with all those dying, it looks like at least, you know, the big question always is where the person treated versus where the nest is really located. And, you know, if it was right next to that hole and he treated it, it's over very quickly. If the nest is 6 feet away, that's where you get these problems. And it's, you know, they did the best they can because that's the hole. The thing, I'm glad he sprayed the baseboard. Sometimes I remember a nephew of mine had a problem, and I went over there and we could watch them. He had a light plate, a switch, and the little stinkers were coming through just a little crack there. And so all we had to do is put a piece of tape there so they could stay going outside. I'm glad that they opened it up. And I can understand why your husband sealed it, but It said once you started to see that they were starting to get forced inside, the best thing you can do is open it up as quick as you can to try to keep them. Now, the spray probably complicates that because many of these sprays also repel them, and so you're kind of pushing them mm-hmm. a different direction. But what I often suggest to people is consider your ceiling lights, consider any electrical outlets, any vents, and again, around window frames, any place you can have a crevice, because what's happening is they're in this dark wall and they see a little bit of a light leak, and that's where they come squeezing through. And so, as I said, so sometimes tape is the best way to keep them in the walls. We're within 4 to 5 weeks of them normally dying out anyway. That would be the good news. But because you've seen so many dead ones, the spray
seems to have been effective.
The spray is effective. You might see a little bit more of a trickling, but I would think that things should be done in the next couple of days. I can't believe, for as many as you found and everything else, that this is going to continue.
There you go, Kathy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist extraordinaire, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Our lines are all filled. You can email us your photos and questions at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Rose in Menominee Falls has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rose.
Hi there. I'm glad I got a hold of you because I've been wondering what this creature is I found. It's, I would say, almost 2 inches long. At first, I thought it was just a grasshopper, but it had almost a shell-like feel to the body of it, and it had almost like a tail-like thing coming out from under it toward the back.
Mm-hmm. And so, a light green.
Yeah, so, you know, the normal grasshoppers that we see, to an entomologist, we call them shorthorn grasshoppers because they have short antennae. But there's another whole family of longhorn grasshoppers, and they have long, thin antennae that are often as long as the body. This include the katydids and the like. And from your description, it's in that family. There's no question. And now which, you know, meadow katydid or there's a number of species, and you have a female because many of the females have an elongated egg-laying device we call an ovipositor that they use to insert their eggs either into the soil or in some cases into plant tissue. Now, in the fall of the year, some of these species, the males are really quite loud, usually up in the trees. They're very territorial, and they also use their kind of raspy call to attract females, and I used to get the call quite commonly. Of every night, all of a sudden the sun goes down and this thing's out in the tree making noise. And trying to find a 3-inch-long grasshopper in a big oak tree is not going to be so easy. But they're harmless creatures, as they said. I know I was out in the field this weekend, out in the prairie, I saw a couple of great big green grasshoppers, a different species. And I said it was from this group. And as you say, they're kind of bulky in the shoulder in the way that the abdomen and the thorax is constructed. They are almost plastic-like. I mean, it almost reminds you of a beetle more because you think of kind of grasshoppers being kind of squishy, but these guys are a little bit more built a little bit better.
There you go, Rose. Thank you so much. Patricia in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning, Larry and Phil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Of late, I think it's the USDA that is now setting up new guidelines as far as what beverages can be called milk and also meat. And with the synthetic meat that is on the market now, I'm surprised that insects are included in the category of meat.
Well, but, you know, if you think of it, shrimp and crabs and whatnot, which are kind of, relatively speaking, close relatives of insects, I would assume would be classified as meat.
Yeah.
And so that's where it comes from. I think it's just, you know, the muscle tissue and whatnot, the proteins involved with it are close enough that I don't know how else you would, unless you had a whole separate category, you know, of seafood, shellfish type things, you know, then that would make sense that you would put insects with them. But if you're just going on a general meat thing, as I said, considering the proteins in the muscle, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Patricia. And Mike in Dodge County. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I had a six foot cherry tree, and I had a bunch of green caterpillars that I identified as Cecropia moths. This was like 3 weeks ago. There was four of them already in cocoons, and the other four were still eating. And I went and checked them like 2 days ago, and all the cocoons and everything were gone. And I was wondering what would have eaten them. Some of the cocoons were down lower to the ground on a tree that rolled up in leaves, and other ones were a little bit higher in the tree, and they're all gone. I was kind of expecting that from my reading that they were supposed to hang on the tree over winter, and they're all gone now. I was just kind of wondering what would have eaten them.
Boy, I would think some rodent-y type thing like a mouse would be my first thing, because again, the way the silk, Cecropia in particular, is on the tree, it's very difficult. I mean, you got to cut the darn thing off, so I'm a little surprised it was so clean, per se, that you didn't see, you know, a hole eaten into it type of thing, because the pupal case, you know, is about an inch long, and again, as big around as your thumb, so there's a lot of food there for something that wants to get after it. Again, a bird I would think would be more of kind of a pecking type injury, and the cocoon would still be on the tree itself. So I wonder if a mouse could take it, and I don't put anything past squirrels, although I wouldn't expect a squirrel to eat a cocoon.
Raccoon,
that doesn't make any
would they?
Sense. Yeah, possibly.
I mean, that might be why everything was gone, if there
right.
you know, something big.
That could take it. You know, raccoon at least would get up in the tree. Skunks wouldn't make sense because I wouldn't expect them to come out. But if skunks found cocoons on the ground, I'm sure that they would be more than happy to feed on them.
There you go, Mike. Thank you. And by the way, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Ruth and Nina next.
Morning. Thank you for taking my call. The question I have is about a grasshopper.
Okay.
And, well, it seems like a grasshopper because it takes off like a grasshopper does, but it's got blue and white wings.
And you saw that in Wisconsin or somewhere else?
I saw that in my backyard, and I saw it up towards the Antigo area.
Okay, I'm a little confused. You know, we do have the Carolina grasshopper, which has black and white wings. And in other parts of the United States, there are other pitcher-winged grasshoppers with reds and all kinds of colors. And that's why I was fishing a little bit, if you might have seen something in an area that I'm not familiar with. I said, I'm not aware of any grasshoppers that have blue to their wings in Wisconsin. But it definitely, you know, your pattern suggests that. And I'm not in my career, one of the things I knew is never say never,
because
every year I'd see two or three things I just had no idea were here. So pitcher wing grasshopper would be my first guess. Might be worth looking on the internet to see if you can see something that fits that pattern. But the blue throws me, as I said, the Carolina grasshopper we have here. It reminds me, there's a butterfly we call the morning cloak butterfly. And at first, when one of those is flying, I think, oh, that's a morning cloak. And then when you see how they land and whatnot, oh, no, that's a grasshopper. And, yeah. So.
There you go. Thanks, Ruth. Robert from Madison emailed. He cut one of two major trunks off his crabapple tree, saw this brown goo. He's got a photo of it here. It isn't sticky, but there are bugs in the goo. Any ideas or what they are, and if his tree is dying?
Okay, the bugs, my first inclination, this is slime flux. I think you've got some bad wood, and this is a form of decay in the wood. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the tree is going to die, but it means it's got a structural weakness, which might be an issue, and things are kind of rotting there. As that tissue rots, and a lot of times the stuff, as the name slime flux kind of suggests, some things are kind of bad smelling, and there's all kinds of interesting fungus-feeding insects and the like that will show up. So I'm not surprised that there are critters in there. I don't know if those are picnic beetle larvae or some other critters I could think of. So as I said, the tree might do just fine. It's not that this is an aggressive disease, but if all the tissue is healthy, you would not have slime flux.
And Timothy from Sauk County is sent in a photo and wondered what the heck he's.
Yeah, so we got another hornworm here.
Yeah.
You know, we had talked before about the one that I think is probably a white line sphinx or something very closely related. This is a different species. I cannot tell for sure because I can't see enough of the patterns. Is this an ash sphinx? It's not a Pandora's. You know, there is about 20, 25 species of hornworm hawk moths in the state. And again, if I had my reference library here, I could probably sort this one out. But it's definitely a hornworm. Again, the color pattern, more typically they are green, but some come in varieties of colors, including this one that is almost, you know, it's a brownish pink, which is kind of attractive.
Yeah, it is. Pretty cool, actually. Andy in Superior, your turn. Hi, Andy.
Hi, yeah. Earlier this spring, I was chopping on a rotten tree stump. And as I did it a couple times, like, the ground was, like, crunching or munching. Like, I was thinking there was some sort of grubs or something in the rotten roots. And I was just curious if that was possible or if I'm crazy.
No. In fact, three possibilities come to mind as far as beetle grubs. Now, all of these, if you know the grubs that you see in the lawn, these things are that times about five in size. Stag beetle grubs are found in rotting wood. There's another scarab beetle called a leather beetle that you find there. And then we even have a rhinoceros beetle in the family, the scarab family, that we find in ash roots. And so it would be one of those three is possibilities. And the thing about all of them is they're in after the fact as things are breaking down. They are not responsible for it. So they're kind of secondary in the sense as far as you don't worry about them affecting the health of the tree. And it was interesting. I was reading a comment about what's going to happen to this rhinoceros beetle associated with ash trees if all our ash trees die.
Oh, yeah, that's
always something
else. Something else to ponder. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, he is the distinguished faculty associate emeritus in the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison. He headed the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab for a long, long time, retired in 2014. But he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 or so today. We'll take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Phil. So stay with us. Looking at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus from UW-Madison's Entomology Department. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening in. Questions, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And send your photos in as well. We've gotten some really cool photos over the course of the program. It's been a lot of fun. Tom in Nelson has a question for you, Phil. So let's go to Tom. Thanks for waiting, Tom.
Yes, am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay, Leningen versus the ants. No, carpenter ants.
Okay.
Inside of a wall. I have no idea where the nest would be. Is there anything that works to get them?
Yep. One of two thoughts. There are some baits, but I'll tell you that I have faith in the baits in the spring, not at this time of the year because their food demands are such. And that's a little bit more of a convoluted control because it's all about getting bait acceptance. The other thing that changed in my career as far as carpenter ant control is back in the day, we'd always say you find the nest and treat it and kill the queen. But if you can't find the nest, it gets very frustrating. And we really didn't have any solutions, but it turns out about 10 years ago, a new group of chemicals came on board, and I know the chemical is fipronil. This is what we put on dogs, and we call it Frontline, you know, and it was registered as a termiticide. That's a product for killing termites, and, you know, termites are not real frequent in this state. But what was found is if you sprayed the outside foundation with this product, the carpenter ants would walk through it. And aside from killing the ones that walked through it, they would transfer it to other ants, almost like it was a bait. And so it was kind of a magic product because if you sprayed a foundation, you could kill the ants in the house. You could even kill a colony 50 to 100 yards away in a tree if enough ants were walking through. And so it's kind of changed the dynamics. Now, the problem is that fipronil is not sold at your local hardware store. It's not marketed to homeowners. It's also restricted how it can be used. It cannot be used indoors. That has more to do with company licensing agreements than it does with toxicity. As I said, you can put it on your dog, but you can't spray it in the house, which is, yeah. But so you can contract for service, or you can go on the internet and go to some of these do-your-own-pest controls and buy a product containing fipronil made for controlling ants and termites and use an outside barrier treatment is what we call it, so spraying along the outside foundation. Because of the time of the year, again, the ants are only going to be active for another 3 or 4 weeks. you know, it's worth getting an ant spray if you knew a spot by a window frame that you could spray into and just see if it works. That's fine. But if you've tried that or you're just not in a place where you could think, as I said, what I would consider is using a fipronil barrier treatment, whether you're a contractor, do it yourself next spring, and it will take care of the ants.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it. Barbara in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Thank you. I'm wondering what would have eaten all of the leaves and the tip growth on my ground cherry. It's a Phasalis type plant, a strawberry tomato is another common name. Mm-hmm. And they're little critters about a half an inch long, very pronounced segments, kind of a worm caterpillar type tapered on both ends, a noticeably like brownish head and a yellowish body.
So those are the larval stage of a type of leaf beetle. Typically when they show up in groups. And so you get that kind of defoliation. As far as, it's late enough now, it's probably not worth getting revenge. But if they show up next year and you want to do something on the organic side, products that contain spinosad as an active ingredient would be effective against it. The more traditional chemicals, 7 would be effective, as would 8. You know, almost any of the garden sprays. They're really not hard creatures to kill. It's kind of a timing thing. And what I would suggest is somehow remind yourself to go out and look at the plants, and when you start to see the first little nicks show up in the leaves, it's time. And spray once, and that should shut it down.
There you go, Barb. Thank you very much for calling. David in Richfield. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Hi, great. I have a question regarding something that a friend of mine is calling pseudoscorpion. These little critters show up every now and again, just individual. They look like a tiny, tiny, tiny little crab with little pinchers.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something indigenous to our area? I've never seen them ever before in any other home I've lived in. It's a weird creature.
Yeah, to be honest, there's a number of species. They're common in leaf litter and outdoors, but unless you're down there with your nose next to leaves, you're not going to see them. But there is one species we find indoors. You never really see high numbers. They're predators. They feed on little ants and little spiders and little, whatever is in the house. They hunt for their food at night, so they're pretty secretive. Totally harmless to people, but scary looking. I mean, if you look at those pincers up there, you kind of think, and usually if you corner one, they kind of wave the pincers around like they're going to come after you. But that's purely to kind of get you to back off. So, yeah, pseudoscorpion is found. The one indoors, I think, is kind of paradomestic, meaning that it goes all over with people. I don't know if I would say it's native to Wisconsin, but now it's native in our homes. And so nothing to worry about. And as I said, they're so secretive that typically any kind of commotion, they go and hide. So that's why I think most people don't see them. You find them in, old towel and linen closets and things that are kind of kept quiet and the like. It's more likely where you'd find one.
Thanks, Dave, for calling. Susan from Gill's Rock emailed to say and sent a photo here of she said, this strange fly while I was walking through Newport Beach State Park, wondering what it was.
So the giveaway to me on this one, if you look carefully at the abdomen, there's a whole bunch of big black bristle hairs sticking out. That's characteristic of a fly family we call the tachinids. Tachinids are parasites of other insects, caterpillars, those kind of things. And the adult fly lays its eggs and the maggots go inside. We had talked about that earlier in the show is a thing. And what's characteristic of these adult flies, as they said, is these bristle hairs all over the body. So it is a type of tachinid, and there are dozens of tachinid species in the state. And some of them are very important parasites of some of the pest species that we have. So these are definitely good guys.
Bob in Fitchburg, on to you now. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yes. Now that we're bringing in some cantaloupe from the garden and tomatoes, and some of them sit on the counter and start to rot a little bit, and we get tons of fruit flies, and it made me wonder, where do they come from? It seems like as soon as a piece of fruit starts to go bad, even if your house is all sealed up, all of a sudden you get all these fruit flies.
Yeah. Another name the entomologists use are vinegar flies. And to me, that anything that gets overripe and you start to, you can smell. Sometimes it's very fragrant, like a cantaloupe, but you can tell it's starting to get a little bit past prime. That's what draws these things in. And outdoors, there's a lot of stuff that's rotting that they can breed from. Now, also indoors. I tell this story, and I hope my daughter forgives me because I pick on her all the time with this one. Is back when my kids were small, my wife gave them some Kool-Aid, and in a paper cup, and she didn't drink it. So we've got sugar base there that's dried up. And what fruit flies breed on is the yeast associated with things fermenting. Mm-hmm. And so out of that sugar-based dried-up syrup of Kool-Aid, we bred about 20 fruit flies. And the problem, though, is that when you see them attracted to something. They're not breeding there. It's stuff that's so ripe and decayed that you wouldn't eat it or think about having it around. But they're always around. And once things start to get the right condition for them to lay their eggs, it's like a magnet, and you draw them in. Typical of late summer, really very infrequent here in the spring of the year. If you see them in the spring of the year, they're breeding indoors, and they can breed all year round if the conditions are right indoors. But outdoors, to me, it's kind of a late summer, fall, you know, as things are ripening and rotting out in the field, and that's where we see them. And, you know, so it's a good idea, you know, if the tomatoes are too bad, too damaged to bring in the house, it's good sanitation to get rid of them, because if they sit there, that could be a great breeding site for fruit flies.
And they get in, you know, they pretty easy to get in on your clothing or whatever.
Or even in some cases, depending on the size of the screening, you know, a lot of screening in the house, they are pretty small critters and the like. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, again, you find it's a bad potato down in the basement you forgot about. Mm-hmm. I can breed hundreds of fruit flies out of a good-sized potato as it's rotting. And so it doesn't take much of a good food source. Also, as we've gotten into recycling, if people don't wash things out properly, as I said, you can get some things caking inside cans and the like that can breed fruit flies.
I can remember from my biology class, we bred fruit flies once, and it was amazing how many could breed in a pretty short order.
And really quick, which is great for the genetics people. And that's why, of course, they've used it as one of their laboratory animals. But it is amazing. But I always tell people, it's not the bananas you see there. You didn't bring them from the grocery store. But as those bananas get ripe, it will draw them. And if you see a bunch in the house, I get suspicious that they have found something in the house that to their liking, and that's what they're breeding on.
There you go, Bob. Thank you. Matt in Middleton. Let's go to you now. Hi, Matt.
Hello. I grow gladiolas for the wholesale market. We plant 10,000-12,000 corms every year. And this year we have had terrible problems with grasshoppers as we've gotten later in the season. But one thing that is curious to me, and both me and my wife, is they seem to always attack the glads that are a red or a reddish type color. They'll chew on the leaves, the green foliage, much more than lighter colors like a white or a yellow that might be growing right next to them. We've been spraying them either with a Lambda Cy Halothrin or another Mode 3A insecticide, and it works for a day or two. And I'm wondering, is there anything that might not be quite so broad spectrum that'll work on the grasshoppers, or are we just stuck at this time of the year?
Yeah, I don't know of anything that's that more selective. Again, on the organic side, something like spinosad might be, but it's still a broad spectrum chewing insect killer type of thing. So you're still going to get some non-target stuff. I'm a little surprised, only in that typically I expect more grasshopper pressures in drier years, just because rains early in the spring tend to be very tough on the nymphs. They tend to drown out. Your observation about color preference, you know, insects have a whole visual scheme different than ours, but you know, that has picked up. People who study insects all the time, you can find some real interesting interactions. And then trying to figure out what they're reacting to gets a little bit more difficult. We've seen the same thing, though, in most areas that I've seen studied. If you've got a bunch of different varieties, you will see a very different insect pattern. And a lot of times it's even visual. In fact, to the point, and this goes back way back when I was first starting, we were worried about virus spreading in gladiolas, and there's aphids involved with that. And one of the ways that we honestly achieve control is they would put aluminum foil along the rows as being reflective. And we know that aphids are very visual, and they use the sky to orientate. And what would seem to be, when they got to the gladiolas and there was all this reflection off the aluminum foil, they lost the plants. Now, I don't expect that to work against grasshoppers, because I think their visual scheme might be a little bit different, although it might be worth trying just to see if there was an effect. And so those kind of things. We also know when people spray, honestly, the different colors it changes for the leaf. If something's a powder, let's say, affects if it's more or less attractive to insects. So they do respond to visual cues.
And that, you know, with 10 or 15,000 of them, I suppose a row cover.
Yeah, might be a little bit not practical. But as I said, my first comment is I'm a little surprised, given the weather this year, that they are so problematic. But late summer is when grasshoppers do their thing. So
there you go, Matt. Thank you very much for calling. Kurt in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Larry and Phil. Japanese beetles. I've been at war with them the last several summers, just enormous numbers of them. I find them detestable, by the way. This summer, not so much. Do they have a natural cycle? Have they left the country? any idea?
Well, you know, I'll go back to my experience watching it in the lab, and I always tease because my mentor was Dr. Chuck Koval, and he retired before Japanese beetle and gypsy moth got established. I never forgave him. but what we witnessed here, and I would think this might feed the pattern you see up in Chippewa Falls, is Japanese beetles start as a trickle. Within 3 years, they're just ridiculous and obscene even as far as the amount of damage. And that can go on for 3 or 4 years. But then in my area of Madison, the population this year, and has been this way for about the last 5 or 6 years, is less than 10% of what it was during the heyday. And a lot
same
of
for
we,
me.
We tend to see that there is a disease, I think, that is affecting the grubs, and that takes some time to get into an area. So I'm hoping that that's what you see. Now, you know, you can get some variability. This winter was nasty enough that it may have helped reduce the numbers, although I've seen them survive 30 below, you know, 20 years ago. So I don't have as much faith in the winter as I do in some other things. But the general trend is it's about a 10-year cycle from establishment to craziness to start getting better. And you might be far enough into it that you're going to continue. They won't go away completely. That will not happen. But it's the point now that we never saw a leaf on my neighbor's birch tree 15, 20 years ago. Now nobody even bothers with them because they don't cause enough damage to mess with it.
And thanks for calling, Kurt. Good news for you anyway. Vince in Edgerton, your turn. Hi, Vince.
How you doing?
Good.
Well, it's an honor to speak with you. You're a wealth of information. Got a question for you in regards to yellow jackets. My neighbor has a colony under his siding, and can I use bleach to help him out to get rid of them?
No.
We
use bleach on insects to get rid of the outside contamination, and the insects live. So, you know, it really, you know, although it has some toxic effects on soft body things, I just don't expect it to work. So this, again, is dust. And, you know, if you're looking for something organic, pyrethrin dust is a possibility. Honestly, I would probably use something different. If I have to treat a nest, I use the old insecticide Carbaryl or 7 in the dust form. 7 is highly toxic to bees, which is not good. But wasps and bees are closely related, so that tells you something here. And again, you know, we used to use it on dogs to get rid of fleas. It's not labeled for that anymore. So it's not an overly toxic product. And I wouldn't use it around a beehive. You know, it is toxic in that case. But, you know, dusting some of it, it's very readily available. And again, the problem is the physical, how do I get the dust there? And that's where, you know, there is something called a bulb duster that you can get at some hardware stores, but an old mustard bottle or an old turkey baster can be used for that kind of application. It's about getting the dust up in there and then just let it be. And as they come and go, they get the dust on their bodies. That's why the pyrethrum dust would work. But pyrethrum breaks down in sunlight, and I'm concerned that the residual isn't long enough. And pyrethrum also has some repellency to it, whereas it may cause them not to want to come out from the hole and drive them somewhere else. And although 7 has some repellency too, it's not near as strong as the pyrethrum. So
there you go, Vince. Thanks a lot for calling. Jan in Viroqua, your turn now. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
I have some ants that have built quite a city in the middle of one of my favorite garden beds. And they're not quite like ants I've met before. They build up, so their nest gets higher and higher. And it's
flat on top instead of domed, and it's got less. It's covered with pale brown granules, and it's now about maybe 10 inches up and 2 feet wide. And the problem is I'm an organic gardener, and I don't want to kill little guys, and I feel terrible when I dig into their nests and eggs, and they're all scurrying around trying to survive. But is there something I can do to dissuade this colony and other colonies from building in my garden?
Yeah, this gets difficult. What you've got is a type of field ant. There's a number of species. And what's characteristic is the colonies live for 10 to 12 years. And in order to control a colony, you have to kill the queen, and she's 3 feet down in the ground. So that's a major dilemma. I mean, people try hot water and other things down there, and I honestly find that that doesn't work very well. Now, in prairie situations and whatnot, they're very important in the ecology because they aerate the soil, they recycle nutrients. So they're a natural thing to have. What's a little bit problematic at times is they often do not like plants in the middle of their nest. In fact, there are some species that we've seen kill 4 and 5 foot Christmas trees. the name of the official name of these are formica, and that's because they contain formic acid. And what they do is they inject formic acid into the roots of the plants, and that kills them. In the case of Christmas trees, we know what's going on is they don't like the shade of the tree because it affects the dynamics, the thermodynamics of the nest. And so that's why they will kill things out in these open fields and the like. So the other thing I've seen, though, is sometimes if you put a new transplant in there, just the activity, the ants going back and forth, is disturbing enough. The roots don't do well. I don't think they like that kind of disturbance. So it's a bit of a challenge. I can argue that they're predators on things, and so they do help you on that side of the equation. But when they're in a place you don't want, they are a stinker to get rid of. They are, and especially on the organic side, I don't have any magic bullets here because I don't have anything. I've often thought that people, something like boric acid, if it was used as a bait, would kill the queen and pretty easy to work with. But I've never seen anybody develop a bait that the field ants could care about. They just don't seem to like the traditional baits that we use for carpenter ants and pavement ants and some of the other problematic ants that we have. So, and if you dig, again, you can remove a whole lot of stuff, but I have a feeling the queen's going to still be down there, and she's the basic mother of all the ants you see, and she will basically repopulate things.
So there you go. There's not much to be done you can kill them.
Yeah, in farm fields where they're tilling the soil on a regular basis, it's enough of a disturbance the ants kind of see. But my take on what's going on here is this colony is 3 or 4 years old minimum to be that strong, to be that big. It's been bubbling for a while, unfortunately.
There you go, Jan. One final thing. Michelle from Manitowoc sent a photo of a bug living in a locust tree. They infest the space between her outdoor screen and inside glass as well, wondering what it was.
It's an adult click beetle. And if you pick this up, you will hear a snap. They have this special little device that they use to flip. The larvae of many of them are found, although there are some we call wireworms that hurt our plants. Most click beetles breed in dead and decaying trees.
Yeah.
And the adults are attracted to light. So nothing to worry about there. Just kind of a natural thing to find outdoors.
Well, Phil, it's always a pleasure. You're back on November 20th. I have.
Hunting season. Oh, boy.
We'll have to see about that. Thank you so much in the meantime. I appreciate it very much. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison. Great to have him with us, and he'll be back and we'll do this again. Tomorrow we'll hear from Chef Josh Perkins about hydroponic gardening and farm-to-school lunch programs. At 11:45, Deborah Blum will be on hand to talk about her new book, The Poison Squad. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.